Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm now joined by Marwan Crady, who is a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He is an expert on Arab media and politics and was the founding director of the Arab Media and Public Life Project at American University. His books include Hybridity or The Cultural Logic of Globalization, Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marwan Crady.
Thank you.
Yesterday, I spoke with a journalist with the only independent newspaper in Bahrain, and obviously Bahrain has receded from the headlines because so much of the world's press attention has been diverted to Libya. But I understand that Al Jazeera, which has played a very strong and positive role in these series of revolutions in the Middle East, has something of a double standard. It has very critical reportage of Mubarak in Egypt and of Gaddafi in Libya, but it essentially backpedals on Bahrain, which is close to home.
Absolutely. If you follow the coverage, one of the things you'll notice is that it started with Tunisia, with what was going on there. The coverage was very active, very committed to the side of the demonstrators, in the sense that there was a general feeling that the demonstrators were on the right side of history, and this is how Al Jazeera was going to cover it. In Egypt, it emerged even more of a player in terms of how it covered the demonstration. It was a bit lukewarm at the beginning, and then within a couple of days, it was again, it went fully into Tahrir Square and other parts of Egypt. And then once the demonstrations in Bahrain came, something very strange happened, which it looked as if Al Jazeera was not as much covering the protest negatively, but it was very ambivalent. For instance, it would show speakers in the name of the Bahraini royal family speaking about vandalism, the demonstrators as vandals, the demonstrators as people who are creating chaos, and chaos is not welcomed. They are subverting social order without giving a chance for any rebuttal of that point of view. While in Egypt, it would have footage of the demonstrators in Tahrir Square, and then it would have a series of Egyptian commentators, poets, intellectuals, professors, writers, politicians, lawyers, commenting very enthusiastically and in many cases very passionately about the uprising. We didn't see anything of that sort with Bahrain.
And this, of course, Marwan Crady, is Al Jazeera Arabic we're talking about. What's the difference between Al Jazeera Arabic's reporting and Al Jazeera English?
Al Jazeera English has been more consistent in its coverage. It's been more even between Tunisia, Bahrain, Egypt, Libya. Although, I mean, the Libya story now is obviously the dominant story, as it is in Western media outlets and Arab media outlets and with Al Jazeera English. But overall, Al Jazeera English has been more consistent.
And what is the relationship of the ruling family in Qatar, the Al-Thanis, with Al Jazeera? I mean, in terms of, let's use the comparison of Rupert Murdoch to Fox.
Yes, it is not. The relationship between the Al-Thani family and Al Jazeera, I would say, is less direct than the relationship between Rupert Murdoch and Fox. The royal family of the ruling family of Qatar did bankroll Al Jazeera when it started. What happened is Al Jazeera was really part of an effort to revamp Qatar's politics, both internally and in terms of its foreign policy. And what Qatar did is it got rid of the information ministry, which a lot of people in the West hailed as a step towards press freedom. And then it launched Al Jazeera, which reported to the foreign ministry in Qatar. And so it's very clear that Al Jazeera is part of Qatar's foreign policy. It's not the kind of propaganda instrument that some people argue it is. It doesn't get direct orders. But I think the broad parameters of its coverage do take into account the agenda and the sensibilities of the Qatari ruling family. One example, one of the things you'll notice is that when Bahrain started, the rulers of the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, which include Qatar, Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia, they met, and there was a decision that we're not going to let this happen here. And as soon as that started, you could tell that Al Jazeera's coverage of Bahrain was muted. Even the last few days, I've also noticed that Al Jazeera's coverage of Saudi Arabia has become even more muted. So Al Jazeera was famous when it started in 1996, and then in the ensuing years of being very critical of the Saudi royal family, for example. And over the years, that has changed. So there was a reconciliation of sort between the Al Saud and Al Thani. You could tell that the coverage changed a little bit. And in the last few days, there is something going on in terms of watching Al Jazeera makes me feel that there's an agreement among the rulers of the Gulf monarchies that we're not going to let the demonstrations that happened elsewhere happen here. And one of the ways in which we're not going to let them grow is we're not going to give coverage to what already exists. Yemen is kind of an interesting story because Yemen is also a neighbor of Saudi Arabia. It's close geographically to Bahrain and Qatar as well. Relatively speaking, evidently, in relative to Libya, for instance. And Yemen is covered a little more than Bahrain, but much less than Libya on Al Jazeera. So as if there's a spectrum of kinds of depth and breadth of coverage that seem to be aligned with the foreign policies of Qatar and its decision to be in solidarity with other Gulf countries.
Again, I'm speaking with Professor Marwan Krady, who is an expert on Arab media and politics. And is the sort of double standard between being critical of military dictatorships and soft-pedaling monarchies? Let's focus on Jordan. How is Al Jazeera covering the uprisings in Jordan, given that that is a monarchy?
It is not. Jordan has been an interesting story in the sense that its coverage of Jordan has been muted all across the media spectrum in the Arab world and globally. Maybe because in Jordan, the famous memo that the king sent instructions about reform and all that were very early. We were still at the beginning of the Egypt uprising when there was a sense in Jordanian political circle that something needs to happen. Coverage of Jordan has been minimal. It's probably relative to what is going on the ground in Jordan, which is, again, relative to Libya, relative to Bahrain, relative to Yemen, not much. So I haven't seen as much coverage of Jordan as I've seen of Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. But I would say it's probably a little more than what Bahrain is getting, but not by much.
Well, what struck me yesterday, Marwan Krady, with the interview I did with the reporter with the only independent newspaper in Bahrain, was that there was a certain nervousness and self-censorship going on within the interview. For example, she would never refer to Saudi Arabia by name, just as a powerful neighbor, and was very careful not to criticize the king, but say that there were those that were trying to drive a wedge between the Sunni minority and the Shia majority and spreading hate through the media, the local media. But at the end of it all, what she called for and what she expected was some kind of constitutional monarchy. It seems that in the Gulf, and I imagine it's true in Saudi Arabia, the sights are not set that high for change as they are in other parts like Egypt and mm-hmm. of course, Libya. Would you agree with that?
Well, a couple of things. So a lot of the demonstrators had been asking for a constitutional monarchy. I mean, don't forget, Bahrain is a very, very peculiar context in the sense that it's a very small country. It's been a playground for a kind of proxy Cold War, so to speak, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, partly because of the sectarian composition, partly because Bahrain is politically to some extent, but socially a lot more liberal than its neighbors. So it has a quite a peculiar status in the region. But there's one very interesting development that happened yesterday, two actually, in Bahrain. One of them was that until yesterday, we've seen a lot of calls for a constitutional monarchy. Yesterday, there were actually calls to turn Bahrain into a republic for the first time in the protests. That's one. Two, there were some very deliberate calls from leaders in the protests for sectarian harmony, for not letting... there's a perception among some of the demonstrators, at least, that the government might use sectarian tensions between the Shia majority and the ruling Sunni minority to stoke these tensions among the protesters and divide them using that as a wedge. So I'm not so sure that the expectations are lower We have seen calls for a republic in Bahrain for the first time after weeks of demands for a constitutional monarchy. So things might be changing.
Now, is this being reported on Al Jazeera Arabic, that what you just said about the calls for a republic?
I haven't watched it. I haven't seen it, but I haven't been watching it 24 hours, so I don't know, but I have not seen it.
In your work that you do, Professor Marwan Crady, who's an expert on Arab media and politics and professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, in terms of this feeling that these regime changes and revolutions in the Middle East are being driven by social media and how the prominent role that Al Jazeera has played, it sort of leads to a very paradoxical question. On the one hand, Google and its executive in Egypt was a hero. So it seems like America, in terms of Silicon Valley, is making a positive contribution. But in terms of all the money that we've spent on trying to set up broadcast American sort of Voice of America type broadcasts in the Middle East, that looks like it's gone nowhere. Give us an update on how Al Arabiya and all these other outlets are doing compared to Al Jazeera.
Well, you know, today there are, depending on who you ask, anywhere between 500 and 750 satellite channels broadcasting transnationally, in other words, with areas of coverage anywhere between Morocco and Iraq, two dozen countries, in Arabic by satellite. Now, among these, in times of conflict, Al Jazeera does remain the dominant channel, even in the countries where there are strong alternatives. Al Arabiya is number two, although my sense is, depending how things go, their coverage of the protests, at least the early coverage, was extremely cautious. They lost, my sense is that they did lose viewers, even more viewers, to Al Jazeera. There are other channels that compete for Arabs' attentions, but they don't tend to be as successful as the two big ones, Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. Al Hurra, from what I understand, is really has a very, very, very minimal following.
And which one is that now?
Al Hurra is the U.S. channel.
Oh,
and don't
the U.S.
forget. So
oh.
We're not talking only about the indigenous channels, which number in the hundreds. You have Al Alam, which is sponsored by the Iranian government. You have Russia Al Yaoum, an Arabic channel sponsored by the Russian government. You have a French channel, a German channel, BBC Arabic. The Chinese have a channel, and the Turks have a channel, TRT7 Al Turkiya. And some of these seem to be at least as popular, if not more, than the American channel Al Hurra. So I do think Al Hurra is not a very good investment for American taxpayers.
And who's behind Al Arabiya then?
Al Arabiya was launched by, it's definitely the main capital behind it was Saudi. It is very close to the Saudi royal family. There was some Lebanese and some Kuwaiti investors at the beginning, but it's definitely reflective of Saudi politics and Saudi foreign policy.
I spoke recently, Marwan Crady, with a Saudi human rights activist in Washington, D.C., and I was stunned by what he said, and I have no way to know whether it's accurate or not, that within Saudi, the young people are probably more social media savvy than they are in Egypt because there's much greater internet penetration, and that they're just as frustrated with the notion that the ruling family, just like the Mubarak ruling family, are sitting on their future. And while they're not necessarily going to go after the king, their hatred is directed at those under the king. And that the notion that we always hear, as we did in Egypt, that, oh, the only alternative to Mubarak is the Muslim Brotherhood. What we're told about Saudi Arabia is that if the royals fall, then the bin Laden Wahhabis are going to take over. This dissident human rights activist said, no way. He said that the Saudi people, the young ones in particular, are fed up with religion and the religious police. Mm-hmm. What's your understanding?
There's definitely evidence that, for instance, there have been surveys that I've used in my own research about Saudis as a people being less religious than, say, Egyptians. Right, so we tend to think Saudi Arabia tends to be portrayed in the Western media as this nation of people for whom Islam is the beginning and the end of their life that dictates everything, that rules everything. That is perhaps the official line that the Quran is the country's constitution, that Sunni Islam is, or Islam is the official religion and all that. And I'm not saying that Saudis are not pious, but there are lots of other issues in their lives other than religion that motivate what they do and how they think. And definitely politics, a sense of justice, issues like the rule of law, issues of the rights of minorities. For instance, the Shia minority in Saudi Arabia is treated like a second class citizen group. Those are all issues that are very important. So I think the claim that the only alternative to the royal family would be Al-Qaeda are exaggerated. Although there's very little evidence from the ground to know who would be an alternative if something were to happen in Saudi Arabia. What we do know is that evidently the Saudi royal family has attempted several kind of preemptive moves. One of them was the distribution of a lot of resources when the Saudi king, King Abdullah, came back from overseas for medical treatment. He announced a lot of raises, social benefits, investments to the tune of more than $30 billion. So major amounts of money to kind of preempt any kind of social unrest. There have also been calls by religious leaders in Saudi Arabia against demonstrations, saying demonstrations are un-Islamic, demonstrations are not the Saudi way of doing things. So they're definitely nervous about what's going on. There have been calls on Facebook for demonstrations. They haven't led to anything major yet, except in the eastern province, which is predominantly Shia. There have been some protests. There have been some repression of the protests, but the Saudi government so far has not been playing the kind of very heavy hand that we see the Libyans, the Libyan regime, or what's left of it playing.
Well, apparently there is a protest scheduled for March the 11th. So, just in closing, do you think that the big shoe could drop? Let's face it, the U.S. has been caught by surprise, and I think in part because of our foreign policy focuses on Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's where all of our Arabic speakers are, all our intelligence assets are. And it looks like we've been completely caught by surprise by Tunisia and by Egypt and even Libya. Mm-hmm. Do you think we're going to get caught by surprise in Saudi Arabia? And as we all know, Saudi Arabia is the 900-pound gorilla when it comes to world energy supplies.
Absolutely. I mean, nobody could have predicted. It's not only the U.S. intelligence community or foreign policy. Those of us who had hoped for political change never expected it to happen so quickly, never expected to see this kind of domino effect from one country to the other. The problem is that you have some kind of contestation in most Arab countries going on right now. Iraq, for instance, there are lots of anti-government demonstrations in Iraq that are not very well covered in the Western media. We have Oman, right? Oman is also a neighbor in the Gulf. And it's not very well covered. Whether Saudi Arabia will fall or not, it's too early to predict, but I wouldn't say it's impossible. I mean, you know, Egypt looked impossible. Six months ago, nobody would have predicted that things would happen so quickly in Egypt. I hate to do a cheap cop-out, but I think anything is possible.
Well, I thank you for talking with us today, Marwan Krady.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Marwan Krady, who is the professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, where he researches Arab media and politics. His books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the growing role of dirty tricks in politics today.